I'm a grateful alcoholic. My name is George.
George.
I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a lot of experience with these steps, especially 6 and 7, because I live in them on a daily basis. More 6 than 7, because my defects are always glaring, and if not to me, to others. I proved that today again before the meeting. But that's part of my humanity, and that's 6 and 7. But I want to do a quick review because I like to do that. There's a lot of information in the 7th step. Now, if you read the big book, you got a paragraph and a prayer at step 6 and step 7. 12 and 12 is a lot more devoted to it. But 6 and 7, even though it's very short and done very quickly when you go through the big book, it's a lifetime process. It's one that you constantly build on. It's one that constantly evolves. So how do we get to 6 and 7? We got to start somewhere, and we started walking in this room. And if you got what I got, you're screwed. It's really that simple. You can't drink comfortably again. Your life was a mess, or if it wasn't, it will be if you continue. And it doesn't matter if you went down as low as I did or you stopped at a much higher place, zero under a bridge or zero on Park Avenue, they used to say Park Place to Park Bench, is still zero. The emotional stuff, the physical stuff, the financial stuff, we all have it to a more or less degree. Whenever you want to stop is when you stop. Nobody has to go to the extreme. Some of us did, the book says. We try to raise the bottom of people today so they don't have to live the last 15 or 20 years of hell that we went through. And you can stop anywhere. So once you have that first step that, you can't drink safely anymore, then you're in a most self, not just in your head. And this is the process of getting everything from our head to our heart. The hardest 18 inches we'll ever have to walk. I have someone sitting in this room tonight that watched me when I first came in here. And for people who think I'm hyper and off the wall now, talk to them after the meeting. They'll tell you how wacky I really was. I was one of those kind of guys that would sit at a table. I'd have 2 cigarettes going in a smoking room, try and get one to my mouth while the other one was still lit, have a cup of coffee, and couldn't get the coffee without spilling it off, and I kept the table all to myself when I got here. And I thought I was cool. Now, that's the way I walked into these rooms. It took a lot of work and a lot of love from a lot of people to spend a lot of time with me. And I think that's real important, whether it's a sponsor, whether it's a support group. There was a lot of people around me that loved me enough because I was unable to love myself, and I didn't think I was worthy of love. And this is all about love, no matter how you want to cut it. So I walk in here restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm living in the four horsemen: fear, bewilderment, terror, despair, frustration. I can go on with a whole lot of negative things that I was in when I got here. And all those things didn't make me feel good. And my solution was drinking, drugging, or anything that took me outside of myself. They tell me that alcohol was a symptom. I didn't believe that when I got here. Well, you took away the alcohol and gambling showed up. You got rid of the gambling, women showed up. You got rid of the women, spending showed up. Got rid of that, eating showed up. Cutting was when I was a kid. I mean, I can go through a whole lot of things that a lot of us have. I had abuse issues. I had non-abuse issues. I had abandonment issues. I had issues. My issues had issues when I got here. And I didn't know what to do about it, you know. So I ran in this circle, and I ran, and I ran, and I ran, and I was lost. You know, there's a little dash in that first step, the hyphen. And if you read a tombstone, the hyphen says, "We admitted we passed over our lives to become unmanageable." That light, that dash is what happens from the beginning to the end. And if you look at a tombstone, born and died. And the dash is the really most important thing. The dash is my story. And my story was ugly when I got here. It's not my story today. It changed. It changed because you people changed me. The grace of this fellowship changed me. So I didn't know what the solution was. So the solution came through a man who was about 6'6" by 6'6", who scared the hell out of me. His name was Kmart Bob Welsh. He spoke to me. He wasn't my sponsor, but he was the guy who said, "George, get here 15 minutes early and save that seat for me." After I saved the seat for him, it was make coffee. It was greet the people at the door. Then it was fold the chairs, unfold the chairs, mop the tables, clean the ashtrays. We had cups in those days. We had to wash cups. And that's how I got it. I got tricked into AA by doing service work. Service work is important. And you got to remember, there's fellowship, there's service, there's recovery, there's traditions, there's concept. There's so much. When you get here, all I wanted to do was not hurt. And I was still hurting. So I had a lot of problems with that second step. But what I did see in step two was I saw a lot of people that were actually happy, and I didn't know how to steal it. I couldn't manipulate it. I couldn't buy it. And I love the second tradition, because the second tradition is what really led me to second step. I saw people that there was a loving God that was working in this room, and I didn't want to talk about God. He expressed himself in the group. And I knew if something was on my mind somewhere in a meeting, if I sat there, and I told the story last week about watching some of my defects, when I walk into a room, something was going on in my life. Whatever it was, the guy didn't take out the garbage at the halfway house, which was usually going on in my life every day. And I was getting these extra chores to do. And what ended up happening was I go in a meeting and somebody else would raise their hand and talk about somebody else not taking out the garbage at the halfway house. And then there would be a solution. And I used to walk out when we got to the God thing. And the reason I say that is because I saw the hope from the people in the room, but I also saw the next step was about God. And I wasn't having none of that. Because God and I stopped talking when I was 7. And I know what the book says. There was something that was impressed in me in childhood. I abandoned the God idea entirely. I can go through all the literature stuff, but in my head, I wasn't talking to God. And it didn't matter. And I got to that third step, and my sponsor and I, you know, I made a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of my sponsor. That was my first decision. So the first person I turned my will and life over to care of was my sponsor. That was the first affirmative action I really took. And then I got to that third step, and I did it. I had an event. I always talk about my event on July 4th, 1994, at a place called Joan of Arc. It was a church. And on the third step, imagine that. I was on my knees with another man, imagine that. And it wasn't to try and rip him off. And I said a prayer with another man. I actually nailed down and prayed with another human being. Something I never did. I mean, where I grew up, we don't kneel down. So, and I had a sponsor that taught me about, you would get on your knees to go for a crack pipe, and you would get on your knees for a bottle of booze, and you get on your knees to throw up in a toilet bowl. Why won't you get on your knees to respect to a power that works in that's working in my life? So out of respect to my sponsor, I started getting on my knees. And we'll talk about that in 7, about how I look at that today. So I had a lot of problem with this, on my knees, off my knees, because it just wasn't working for me. But I was doing it anyway. And my decision in step 3 was to turn my will and life over to care of the rest of the steps. Got to that fourth step, and I talked about my immoral inventory, because that's what I had. Live on the streets in New York for 5 years in a cardboard box. You're not very moral when you get here. I didn't get here because of my assets of character. I got here because I was broken, defeated, and they were my defects of character. You know, and wasn't going to share in step 5 with God, another human being, and I knew what I was. You guys didn't need to know what I was. I was a low life that came from the street and wasn't worthy of nothing, and I was a worthless piece of garbage, and that's what I felt when I walked in here. And I had people tell me that feelings aren't facts. I don't give a damn. That's how I feel. It's my truth. And they tell me, your truth is good enough, but it's not the truth. We need to find the truth. And we're going to do that through steps. So I did that immoral inventory. I did the fifth step. I believe we do a fifth step for 3 reasons. We go to God for forgiveness, which I wasn't doing. We go to another human being to practice humility. And we go to ourselves, when we write the fourth step, for understanding. So I did that. Then after I sat for the time, for the hour with my sponsor, figuring out what my will is, what God's will is, I don't get hung up on that. My will is my thoughts. My life is my acts. And my thoughts and my acts stunk. And they told me A stood for attitude adjustment. And I needed my attitude adjusted. And then there was a big sign in the room I came in. It was about as long as the wall in the back. And it said, gratitude. And I used to hear, gratitude is about attitude, and attitude is about action. Little things helped me along the way. The fourth step, when I was writing it, they said the pen light step. If you don't pick up the pen, you won't see the light. All little cliches and sayings. The signs, live and let live, easy does it, but for the grace of God, think, and first things first. I never could remember that. My sponsor said, it's real simple. Live easy, but think first. So these little acronyms and these little sayings started me hooking into things. And I didn't realize that sobriety was sneaking up on me. I wasn't happy. I wanted to get high. And I sat in these rooms doing all the work to show you that it wasn't going to work for me. I was going to prove it wrong. I talked about it 6 months. I walked out of a meeting, and I served with papers to get my kids up. And all my defects of character came flaring when I threw a chair across the room and wanted to get in a fight and knocked over a bookcase. And somebody said, pick it up and go talk to somebody. And somebody asked me what kind of custodian I was. And told them all the things I did, and they said, we didn't ask what you did. We're asking what kind of custodian you were. And I realized I was an absentee father. One of the reasons I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was not to get sober. I wanted my kids back in my life. And at 6 months, I walked out, and they were yanked out of my life very painfully. And I struggled with that for a very long time. And I don't know why my mind is out to get me, but I know that I watched people with less sobriety getting more than I was. They were happier than I was. Their minds were clearer than mine was. They had a car, they had a girl, they had a picket fence, and I had absolutely nothing but pain and misery. And I couldn't get away from it. And I didn't know how to let go of it. You know, but I did the third step because I was told to keep saying the third step prayer. If you read the third step prayer, it does not end with amen. There's a, between step three and step seven, there's a whole lot of prayers. Since we started, right now we're in step seven, there's seven step prayer. There are 20 prayers in the first 76 pages we're through. I knew one, third step prayer. I read the others, but I never saw them. I didn't see they were talking about meditation in the fourth step, although I was doing it. I didn't see it in the fifth step, although I was doing it. So my defects were right there, and I couldn't see what I couldn't see. So I did the discovering, the uncovering, the writing, the discarding. I did all the work. I was trying to get good in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I'm trying to lead up to six and seven, because it's not about getting good anymore. It's about getting healthy. See, getting good, doing the deal, doesn't mean I'm going to get the result. I did the deal for 5 years of my recovery, and I did not get the result. If anything, I was losing more things in recovery than I did before I got here. And that process was very painful. I met a girl in my recovery. I was living with her for 4.5 years. At year six, I cut my hand with a circular saw. Lost a girlfriend, lost the house, was living in my car at 6.5 years of recovery. Didn't want to drink. Definitely thought about taking a car and driving it into a wall, but didn't want to drink. Didn't do that either. But somehow or other, God's grace came in, and this is seven, and helped me with that. The first thing I had to clean up was my language. Last week I went through about 160 different negative assets that I walked into the sixth step with, all these this negativity that I had in my whole life, and that was my truths. They weren't real, but they were mine. You know, I talk about my dad, you know, and I talk about how I saw what my father was. He was an absentee father, the same as I believed I was. And he worked three jobs to support a family. He loved his children. Now, that's not what I saw. I saw Dad wasn't home. He didn't love me, but he loved my sisters. Don't ask me where I got that. Whether it's true or not, if that's true or not, it doesn't matter. My job in six and seven is, how do I learn to live in my own skin? Because I didn't do that well. Did my father and mother do a good job? Didn't they? It really doesn't matter. I'm here because I can't live well. And when they gave out that part of living, the book on living, I didn't get the page. I missed it. Or in school or whatever it was. And I just wasn't in line for that. So I get to this sixth step and I have all these defects. And, you know, am I willing to let go of them? Most of them. Not all of them. Some of them I like. I like that feel good. I like that adrenaline rush. I don't want to give that up. That was defined who I was for a long time. That was my living skills. I still can walk down in the hood and know I'm in the hood, man. I'm right at home. My neck goes up, the hair goes up. I know where I am. I know what's up. I know what time it is. I know, and nobody bothers me. Why? Because my streak comes out. Didn't go away. Still there. So I get those defects that kept me alive my whole life still right in front of me. And they know how, and I know how to use them. And how to use them to hurt people. I had a very cutting mouth when I got here. Still do. I just practice not letting it out as much. And those are things that took a lot of time and a lot of effort. So, you know, I'm here trying to figure out what principles am I living by. My principle when I walked in here was what's mine is mine and what's yours is going to be mine. It's the way I lived. And if I can't buy it, I'll steal it. And if it's, you know, my language was not very nice. I wrote down something the other day. I was talking to somebody about language, because when I came in here, I had very few words that didn't have four letters. Maybe and, there, maybe, you know, today, tomorrow. But most of my language is pretty good. And I walked in the room, and my sponsor used to say to me, "George, you don't go to your doctor and say, 'Fix my effing problem.' You don't walk into the bank and say, 'Give me my effing money.' You don't go to church and say, 'God, I'm effing here.' Why do you have that much disrespect for the people in this room?" And I didn't get that at the beginning. See, he was working on a defect that I didn't even know I had. See, that was my normal. Well, I got to show you how tough I am. That ain't tough. That's vulgar. It's offensive. And it hurts people. And I tell the story of a young lady. My sponsor tells the story of a young lady when Bob was alive. He told me the story of this woman. She was just lost her husband, drank a little too much. And she comes into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's sitting in the room. And some asshole like me gets up there and starts talking about, I don't want to drink today on the third tradition. And then starts talking about shooting dope and all kinds of other stuff that I like doing because I want attention and I'm very important. I'm the newcomer. What I do is that person does not identify with me. And they're sitting there and comparing. And they say, this never happened to them. And they go outside and they drink and they die. See, my message carries weight, not only in a positive way, but sometimes in a very negative way. So I got to be careful what I say up here. I have my own opinions, and I also have what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had to change my language. And the way I learned to change my language is every time I used that language that was not healthy, I had to stand up in a room of people and tell them I was sorry for the language I used. If you're like me, you don't want to get up in front of a room of people and tell them you're wrong. You just don't want to do that. So that took me a while, and that was the first visible thing in a change of behavior between 6 and 7 that I didn't even know I was working on that was happening in my life. You know, we talk about the sixth step, and we talk about willingness as being the key. It talks about it in the big book. It says, can he take them all, every one? And if we still cling to something that we want to hold on to, we pray for the willingness to become willing. I prayed for the willingness that my wife be very happy far away from me. You know, that's what I wanted when I got here. I wasn't wishing her death anymore. I wasn't wishing her pain or hurt. I wasn't sitting in the rooms in my head plotting how to get to New York and kill her and sneak back so I can get my kids back in my life, although that's what I did at the beginning. And I learned how to make honest prayers. Somewhere in that third step, and the prayer life was very important to me. And I didn't even know, because I wasn't a prayer when I got here, how important prayer became. Somewhere between that third step, I do this with my sponsors, I have them write their own third step. Because I was told if I say the same thing over and over again, all I'm doing is mouthing words. It's not the words I say, it's the petition I make, it's where it comes from. And getting it from my head to my heart, and that speaking from my heart, those prayers were very important to me. I knew the third step prayer. Doesn't mean nothing if I'm just saying words. It means more to me when I say, "God, take it, I can't deal with it. Help me." That means more to me than the third step prayer on certain days. I'm out of control. I need your help. Guide me. Show me what to do. There's lots of great prayers in there that are throughout the big book. And I'm using them all. And I don't even know I'm using them. I always tell the story. I was late for work one day. I ran out of work. I got up late and I was running out for work. And I was out of the halfway house. And I got out the door and said, "Oh, shit." Ran back in, got on my knees, said, "God, I'm late for work. I'll talk to you later." Bah, boom. That was my prayer, but I didn't drink that day. Now, did that work or didn't that work? I don't know. All I know is I need to say that prayer in the morning. And my prayer in the morning is a guy by the name, we were just talking about a guy by the name of Joe Kelly. Joe Kelly used to be a cop from Boston. He worked as an employee assistant program guy. And I know Joe for many years, and one of his sponsees, who I know, and I didn't know was his sponsee, just spoke the other night, and I was listening to him. And Joe Kelly used to say something, you know, when I first got in here, I'd say, "Oh, God, it's morning again." And Joe Kelly used to say, "Why don't you turn that around?" Instead of saying, "Oh, God, it's morning again," say, "Good God," you know, instead of saying, "Good God, it's morning," why don't you say, "Good morning, God." And that's what I do to this day. I get up and I say, "Good morning, God. Thank you for another day." No matter what's going on. Whether I'm feeling okay mentally, whether I'm physically okay, whether I'm spiritually okay, that's what I learned to do. So I'm coming out of this sixth step with all this negativity. I do a fifth step. I think my sponsor is going to tell you all you guys what I'm going through, and I'm scared to death. and I'm not comfortable in my own skin. So you see, 6 and 7 is about comfortability. There's a couple of things. There's a couple of promises in the sixth step. One of the promises in the sixth step is that we abandon our limited objectives and move towards God's will for us. I have objections with God. I start moving him out of the way, and I start moving towards what he wants me to be. And then God has granted us a perfect release from our alcohol. See, I didn't have a desire to drink all of a sudden. This guy who used to sit in the meeting wondering about drinking, one day gets up and says to his sponsor, "Hey, I didn't think about drinking today." He said, "Great, whatever you did today, do it tomorrow." I don't know what I did different that day, but it was removed. I didn't do it. God did. So the power of God was already there. So I get to the seventh step now, and it specifically concerns us with humility. We talked about humility as a word. Every one of the steps has to do with humility. I like the definition of the word humility in the 12 and 12. The word humility in the 12 and 12 is that for those of us made progress in Alcoholics Anonymous, humility is a word often misunderstood. It's a clear recognition of who and what we are by a sincere attempt to become what we could be. See, I knew what I was when I came in here, and I didn't know how to get rid of that. And you guys gave me hope to be something different. So through that process, I was practicing humility. You want to get a room quiet, go to a discussion meeting and say, "Let's talk about humility." You'll hear people make all kinds of opinions of what humility is. Humility, they'll say, "Well, if you're talking about humility, you ain't got any." All right? I don't know if that's true. All right? Humility, as defined in the dictionary, because I love the dictionary, it's a quality of state of not thinking you are better than another person. It's real simple. The quality of state of being humble. Well, I didn't know what that meant, so my sponsor said, "You know, humility is just being right-sized, George. That's all it is. Get right-sized and you got humility. Don't be afraid to tell people where you came from. Don't be afraid to say what you've done and where you've gotten to. But don't boast about it. Do it quietly." And I do a lot of things I don't tell people, and that's what I was told to do. So here I am practicing humility in a different way than I knew how. So I'm doing a third-step prayer. I now get to the seven-step prayer. I'm doing a third-step prayer. I'm doing a seven-step prayer. I'm practicing doing positive things. I'm trying to act my way into better thinking. I'm doing all the things I'm told to do, and I'm still uncomfortable in my own skin. So I go to meetings, and I love when we talk about step six. We talk about shortcomings, and we talk about character defects. We're willing that God remove all our defects of character is the sixth step. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings is the seventh step. If I sit in a room and I hear what people say and I listen to what people say, I can go crazy. Some people will tell you a defect is something that you're born with. A shortcoming is something you do. It's this or it's that. My sponsor said, "Why don't you find out the information and then figure it out for yourself? And don't listen to opinions, because opinions in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous will kill people." And I went to the dictionary, and a shortcoming, just so everybody hears it, is an imperfection or a lack of that detracts from the whole, a quality of state of being that is flawed or lacking. A defect, an imperfection that implies impairs worth or unity. The grave defects in a foreign policy, an imperfection. Lack of something necessary for completeness, adequacy, or perfection. They're the same. All right? Bill Wilson was very smart when he wrote. And he wrote that because he didn't want to repeat words. They are one and the same. So whether it's a defect or a shortcoming, I got it. And if I got it, what am I going to do about it? I'm not going to sit there and try and rationalize which one it is and what I got to do. Is it internal? Is it external? Is it what I'm doing? Is it what I'm thinking? I got it. What do I do with it? Well, I was told I can't think my way to good acting. I got to act my way to good thinking. So in the sixth step, I had all these flaws that I had, and I got to get rid of them in seven. And the way I got rid of them is I did the opposite of what I had in six. I tell my sponsees, and like it was done with me, I slowly got these chips, and on the one side I had all the negatives, and on the other side I put all the positives. And every day I was to pick out a chip and look at it, and the poker chips, the same ones we use, and I would look at the asset and work on that for a day. That doesn't mean I didn't work on other ones, But that was the one that I had to keep in the front of my head. And if I didn't put it in my pocket, I know in 20 minutes I'd forget about it. And whenever I go for change or something, I'd pull it. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, I forgot I was supposed to be working on honesty. No wonder I've been lying all day. You know? And I don't know how many times that chip, that or whatever was going on in my life, was right in front of me. When I got here in the seventh step, it concerns ourselves with that word humility. No alcoholic can stay sober without humility. Humility starts when I walked in here and I said, I need help. That's the most humble act I can do to anybody. It just came again when I asked a sponsor to help me. It came again when I asked somebody to guide me through the steps, which was my sponsor. That was all acts. At every step I was doing, I was getting more humble because I was getting more honest. Honesty was a process. So this thing of how do I work a seventh step? Because at first I got to work it. Because first I'm introduced to it by my sponsor. And then I started working because he gave me work to do on it. And then after I did the work on it, I started to apply it. And eventually he told me if I did that well enough and long enough, through practicing it enough, I would start living it. And that's one of the greatest gifts you get in the seventh step. I start to live these principles that are very positive in my life. And the ones that are negative start falling from it. Not all of them, but they start falling. It says, in all our strivings, many of them well-intentioning, crippling handicap have been the lack of humility. We lack the perspective to see that character building and spiritual values had to come first, and material satisfaction was not the purpose of living. For you guys who have been with me from the beginning, one of the biggest things I dealt with is my three higher powers: money, property, and prestige. That's how I lived. Bigger, better, you know, playmates, play toys, and play things, they used to say. And that's what it was. That's what it was all about. More. The disease of more. And that's a warped perception for me today. And it tells us in our big book that for us, spiritual well-being always preceded the material, not the other way around. So if I'm chasing money first, I'm in the wrong path. I'm going to lose it. If I'm chasing the wrong, faulty relationships, I'm going to lose them. I didn't want to hear that. If I'm not putting my recovery first, anything I put before it, I'm going to lose. And that's about the spiritual growth. And I didn't want to grow spiritually. I wanted my things back. I wanted the toys back. I wanted the girls back. I wanted the house back. I wanted everything back. And you know what? I got none of it back. That's my experience. I lost it all. I lost more when I got here than I had more when I was out there. It's a terrible thing to say. And I lived in the Bronx. I had more money anyway. I didn't have more things. My wife had all the things. I had the money. She got the things. I got the money. And it's all things. It's all things. It's all money. And it was all warped. Because I had faulty judgments on how to handle that stuff. A whole lifetime geared to self-centeredness cannot set reverse in once. Rebellion dogs are every step. When my sponsor said, you get up a half hour early and you spend a little time in quiet and peaceful time, I didn't know how to do that. He said, I want you to take a minute a day and practice meditation. I said, I can't do that. I used to sit in the backyard of the halfway house I was at. They used to have a cardinal that flew by every morning. And I used to watch that fly by every morning. And I used to sit and watch that cardinal. And I used to have a little pond out there. And I used to be able to see, he told me to be still for 20 seconds. And then after 20 seconds, it became a half a minute. And then after a half a minute, it became 45 seconds. I sit still every day for an hour a day today. And if you know me when I got here, people tell you that would never happen. And I don't have a problem doing it. I like solitude today. I like my own skin today. It took me a long time to be able to sit in it. It took me a long time not to want what you had. And how do I get it? It took me a long time not to think money was my goal. It took me a long time to let go of old ideas. Absolutely, so the grace of God could come in and expel all those things that kept me looking at life through a bad pair of glasses. It says, we got to try or we fall by the wayside when it comes to the seventh step. How do I try? You know, I used to hear, you try, you die. You know, trying is setting yourself up for failure. There's only certain things that I can try to do. One of the things I do on a daily basis, and it's not trying anymore, it's the actions I take. I got to take certain actions. I got to get up and ask God in the morning. Because my God is such a gentleman that if I don't ask him in, he ain't coming in. I don't think God really cares what job I have. I don't think God really cares whether or not I'm doing what I think is the right thing. I think God cares that I ask him in. I used to tell my sponsor I'm praying to God. He says, good, keep doing it. He likes to hear from strangers. I was strange to God when I got here, you know, and I didn't like the stuff my sponsor said to me. So it says, at this stage with progress, we are heavy pressure and coercion to the right thing. We are obligated to choose between the pains of trying and the penalties of failing to do so. These initial steps we take along the road, we take grudgingly, yet we take them. You know, some of the things that happens to us when we're here and we're starting to do the right thing, and one of the things I have a problem with is, and I say it all the time, and I believe it to my innermost core, is you cannot walk around looking good on the outside and be dirty on the inside and stay clean and stay sober. You're going to use. Eventually it's going to catch up to you and you're going to use. So, you know, when you have time and you're denying someone else their recovery, and I don't give a damn which sex you are with that, talking about sex there, if you're hurting someone else's recovery, if you're not, eventually it's going to take you out. I watched it over and over again. And in the book, it tells us on page 70, suppose we fall short of a chosen ideal and stumble. Does that mean you're going to drink? Some people tell us so. But it's only a half truth. Depends on us and our motives. If we're sorry for what we've done and we ask God to take us to better things, we will be forgiven. But if we're not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. Now, Bill is very smart. That's, you know, hidden in the middle of the sex inventory. And then right underneath it, it says, and we treat sex like any other problem. So if that is like any other problem, that little statement, that applies not only to my sexual conduct, that applies to all of my conduct. Whether it's the way I treat my fellow worker, whether the way I behave on with my friends, whether I'm lying or manipulating, if my conduct is hurting someone, eventually I'm the one going to get drunk. So I have to be real careful of the things I do. Now, I can't walk on eggshells because I'm a human being, but I can correct it, and I'll do that later on in other steps. So that humility, when something is going wrong, and I go and tell, like I tell this story, I was sitting in the third row of box on Christmas of 95, and I walked into an AA meeting and I said I was sitting in the first row of the box. I should have been grateful that somebody gave me a ticket to go to a box seat and enjoy a game. But I had to make it bigger than it was. So like the things I learned is that things aren't always as good as I try to make you think they are, and they're never as bad as I tell you they were. Somewhere in the between is that truth. And there's that balance. And that sixth and seventh step is about that balance. And the seventh step is where I find my balance. See, because I know about the sixth step. I lived in it for so long. Dr. Bob, go to early AAs. Dr. Bob used a book for all his sponsees in early AAs, The Imitation of Christ by Thomas Kempis. It was a required reading if you went with Dr. Bob's sponsee. He also had you read Father Lawrence. Now, these were very religious people that live spiritual lives. And we're on a spiritual journey here. And just because it's religious doesn't mean it's not spiritual. Had a lot of problem with that when I got here, too. So because of those kinds of literature and the people around me, I had a lot of problem being quiet in my head. I don't know about anybody else, but my head's very busy. 18 and a half years later, my head is still very busy. It doesn't go away. But what I do is I have tools to deal with it. And I was given a blessing because when they told me to be still and not think, or not have anything go through my head for meditation, I went nuts. I can't do that. I think about not thinking, and that's all I was thinking about, you know. And I went out even on 11 step, and where does this all come from? I was introduced to a guy by the name of Thomas Keating. is a call, talks about centering prayer. And what ended up happening with Thomas Keating and centering prayer is I learned that if I sit on the lake, and this is just a visual I do, and let a boat go by, I can actually watch my thoughts go by and not jump on the boat. What a concept that was. And that was how I learned about centering prayer, which is a way of thinking through prayer, which is a form of meditation. It's a whole process. It's not AA, but it's a tool that helped me to get more centered in AA. So it says we look to see where religious people are right and where we can use what we can use that they give us to enhance our recovery. So I used a lot of outside things. I tried, doesn't matter, Tibetanism, and I read the Holy Man, and I read the Four Agreements. I would read anything people, the Shack, whatever was around that was spiritual, that gave me some kind of feeding to help me purposeful life. I can go on. My head starts getting conversations with God. The list goes on and on and on and on. But that's what I did, because out of everything I've ever picked up, something spiritual was entered into my recovery, which was helping me in my seventh step. So those were things that were tough for me. It says we look to see where medical, psychological, and religious people can help us. I needed them all. I had to go outside for help to deal with when I cut my hand off and I came down with cancer and I had hepatitis. I have a lot of medical issues that were going on. I needed medical help. AA was not going to give me. If I came in here and told you guys what was going on and you told me what to take, I'd be under a bridge again. No doubt in my mind where I'd be. So I needed medical help, but I needed someone in the medical profession that I had to seek out that understood us. And when I went to a therapist, I found somebody who was in this program that I respected enough to go to them. And that's what I did. And it tells us that on page 132 and 133, that the good doctor and good psychiatrist are there for us to use. I don't belittle them. Although I hear a lot of things of what you can and can't do or should and shouldn't do in AA, I have no opinion on that. I read what the literature says. I read what's in the book for the information. I do what's in there for the transformation. If it wasn't for the people in here that love me enough and long enough and hard enough that could show me those things that I could hear, I wouldn't be here. And it's real important that I needed those people around me, that the sponsor and my support group. And that's all seven-step work for me. They worked with me long enough and loved me strong enough. That's what they did. And when they did that, they gave me enough hope that I could move forward because I didn't have to stay stuck and stupid because I wasn't using my own thinking anymore because my disease is in my mind, not in yours, in mine. So I got to the seventh step, and I ended up having a leg operation. I wasn't allowed to kneel, so I couldn't get on my knees and pray. I freaked out. Oh, God, I'm going to use. What am I going to do? I'm going to get drunk again. My sponsor said, why don't you find a little spot, make a little, I made a little awning, I had a little seat, I was smoking, I was at that time, had a little table, a little archway, and cigarettes, and coffee, and meditation books, like six of them. One's not enough for me, I need six at a time. I want to get healthy, I'm trying to get good again. I was afraid if I didn't kneel, I was going to die, you know. And my sponsor said, you know, George, God doesn't care what position you come to him. He cares about how you pray to him. And I would pray in the car. I still don't listen to a radio in the car. I still talk to God constantly. I don't know if he hears me or not, but all I know is I'm at peace today. And that's something I didn't know how to get to. The seventh step is about a new surrender, a new willingness, and a new happiness. That's what the seventh step was for me. And part of the things that I came into the seventh step with was a lot. The seventh step gave me a lot of tools. You know, last week I read off a whole lot of negativity. Let's turn it around a little bit and give you guys some hope here. Because last week, if you all listened to what I said, you all got, well, man, this is going to be miserable. I was miserable when I did my sixth step. Here's what the seventh step gave me. It gave me the ability to take action. I was not afraid to admit what was going on. I got a new awareness. I had found out I had some assets in my life. I had learned how to do amends. I knew about restitution. I had acceptance. I started achieving. I started getting okay with you guys. I got brotherhood, something I didn't have when I got here. I had some balance. I had beliefs. I started to care about other people. I actually got contented with being by myself, something I never knew how to do. I got some confidence. I had companionship. I learned how to cope with some heavy things. in my early recovery. I learned some calm. I learned some clarity. I had some comprehension. I learned some consideration. I was considerate of others. That's my favorite one. If I'm practicing consideration, I am practicing the best form of love I know how for everybody. Because without consideration, I'm back in selfish and self-centeredness. I got some change out of that. I learned some character building and some decency, which I didn't have when I got here. I learned some God dependence. I was able to disclose what was really going on. I had a desire to learn more. I had determination. I was learning discipline. I had directions. I started puncturing that ego that walked in this room that you guys don't understand. I'm different. And here's my favorite one, yeah, but. And every time I go, yeah, but, my sponsor asked me if I was a motorboat. Yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but. Everything he said, yeah, but. Yeah, there was no yeah, more yeah, buts. I got effective in what I was doing. I made a lot of effort. I got freedom. That freedom was wonderful. And I didn't even know I was free because I was still looking at the chains that I was carrying around me. And yet I was free. There was faith. I was fearless. I knew the facts about myself. I had truth. I became forthright. I learned a lot about forgiveness. I started forgiving things that I didn't think I would. That ex-wife that I prayed was far away from me and happy, I actually wanted her to be happy. Started praying for her real happiness. Something I didn't know how to do for that until that point. I got a lot of grace. God graced me with a lot of things. I've got a lot of a relationship with God. I started really starting to have my first relationship with God in step 7. I had gratitude. There was goodness. I got more honest. I got happy. I was helpful. I was hopeful. I've got humility to some more degree than I had. I had integrity, insight, and I was becoming instinctive. I knew how to take inventory now. I learned about good judgment. You know, I love when people say, don't judge, you'll be judged. You better judge. You want to know who you want to see, you want to hang out with. Just don't tell them that you're judging them. And if you get biblical, it says, judge not, or ye shall be judged. The next line says, but judge the righteous, for they hold the keys to the kingdom. There's a line in there that we don't talk about. You better know who you want to be around. Because if I don't sit down and if you're going into a crack house or to a bar, I don't want to go with you. It's real simple. Because that's not where I want to go anymore. So I better judge what you're doing. I just don't have to tell you. I don't have to be judgmental about it. I can let you live where you are, do what you need to without me being part of that. I got some knowledge on this. I had liberation. I learned to listen. I learned a lot about love in 7. I learned to give from my heart, and no more want to take from you. I got some morality, and I learned about meditation. I got some morals, became a little more open-minded, objective, obedient to God, because that became routine. That discipline, obedience of praying every day, reading my literature, calling my sponsor, became such a routine by the time I got to this step that it was a way of life, and it still is. My sponsor, I spoke to the last 4 days in a row. He doesn't even know who I am anymore. So I'm speaking to someone else who is part of that group because he's getting old. He's 94 years old. But he's a lovely man, and I will not change him. He was married 61 years. He had everything I wanted when I got him. And he was my third sponsor. I always joke, I chased 2 out of town, and I buried 1. And now I'm about to bury my 2nd one. But I was able to be there. I've got some purpose, and I learned progress, patience, and I learned persistence. I had peace of mind. I had perspective. I learned principles and peace, and I learned a lot about prayer. I know about quiet time, so now steps up to here, a lot of them. Quality of my recovery changed. I learned how to reflect and recognize. I learned about restitution and relief and responsibility and reassurance and I learned how to seek and get security and give sacrifice, give of myself so someone else might get some help. I learned spiritual values and self-discipline, and clearer thinking. I got some serenity and strength, and a little bit of spirituality. Service was very big for me, and selflessness and serenity, and stock-taking, and tolerance, and thoroughness, and trustworthy. I became trustworthy. I got a key to a house after a year. I was so excited about that. They gave me a key to a room, man, with where there was a safe in it. And nobody said, don't take anything. You could go in there and you had access to a room. Those were big things for me. I remember the very first guy I heard speak. I was at a treatment center, and he had 1 year, and he talked about a wallet for the first time and a key to a house. And that was my hope, because that I related to. Because I lived on the streets for 5 years. I had no ID. No one was going to know who I was. And after a time, I had that wallet and that key, and that meant a lot. So, you know, little things mean a lot when we first get here. I became useful and understanding. I became very willing. I got some values, and I learned some virtues. You know, I like to tell stories. My sponsor, Bob, Christmas. The Christmas of 1995 or 6. 95. He was, 95. He was 96. He was not feeling good. It was Thanksgiving, and I went over to the house, and I went in the house, and he was angry, and he was bitter, and he was moaning and groaning about this guy. My sponsor had very bad language. Although he corrected mine, he never corrected his. Do as I say, don't do as I do. Sounded like my father in a lot of ways in that. But he corrected mine very well, and he was really moaning and groaning about a guy named Archie. For the people up in the Stelray area, he used to be a man who was in a wheelchair. He lived in up here, and him and Bob were best friends. And for whatever reason, Archie didn't call him for Thanksgiving, and he was really upset. And I said, you know, Bob, my sponsor once said to me that if you got a problem with somebody, pick up the phone and call them. Practicing my seventh step. And he said to me, shut the hell up, get around. Yelled at me and sent me out of the room. And then he called me back and he called him. And I got a blessing the next week. It was right before Christmas. I got to sit at a table with a guy by the name of Bob Welsh, Helen Hart, for the old timers that have been around here, and a few people don't know, who may have heard Helen's name. Dave DiOrio. Archie, and a guy by the name of Eddie Dalton. And there was six people at that table. It was 150 years of recovery. I had like three. I was a baby. And it was one of the most powerful moving experiences over a piece of pizza that you can imagine. Still carries in my heart. The hope and the love that I got at that table from those people still carry with me today. I stand on the shoulders of giants. So the seventh step is about doing these right things, you know, and Bob passed. And Bob taught me about dignity and death. And because of that, I was able to be there for my mom. And I was able, when she went home, and because when she went home, I was able to be there for her. And after she went home, I had a friend of mine, her name is Kelly Peck. Kelly Peck had 13 years in the program. All the women gathered around her. This is a fellowship of men and women. And I'm saying that for a reason right now. And Monday to Saturday, they all sat with her while she was in hospice, a 13-year-old little child. And every Sunday, I got to spend the last 6 months of her life with her in prayer and meditation. Didn't have much, but I traveled all the way from Pembroke Pines every week on a without a license. Somebody gave me a car to be with her. Do what you got to do sometimes. And every Sunday, I sat there and I spent Sunday morning until I went to work on Monday with her. And I was there when she went home. And that's just one of the blessings you get by doing the next right thing. And I've learned about death, and I've learned about life, and I've learned about integrity. And it's all in the seventh step, you know. And every morning, I get up and I'm real grateful for those things that were given to me by those people that walked before me. Because that love is something that we talk about. See, that's not things I can learn or read in a book. These are things you got to experience. The only way you experience is living through it with people who have lived through it. You know, I was going to talk about the seven deadly sins we talked about last week. I want to end with two things. And one of them is we talk about the negativity in step six. Well, faith, generosity, gentleness, joy, kindness, love, patience, peace, and self-control are the opposites that handle those things. Those are the assets. Now, not being religious. We see where religious people are right. Those are called the fruits of the Spirit. In case anybody doesn't know where that comes from, it comes from the Bible. It's one of the things, if I practice those, like my sponsor said, if I practice the Ten Commandments and the 12 Steps, I'll be okay. I don't do that real well. I'd probably ruin most of the commandments for me before I got here. It's all about affirmative action. You know, last week I read a thing that my sponsor gave me in Step 6 and 7. What we are is God's gift to us. What we become is our gift back to God. Sixth and seventh step. Sixth step, I had to stop doing what was wrong for me. Not for anybody else, but for me. And in the seventh step, I started doing what was right. One of the greatest gifts I got, it was a prayer that was given to me. And I love this prayer. It's in a little aside from the seventh step prayer. It says, Dear God, so far today, Lord, I have done all right. I haven't gossiped. I haven't lost my temper. I haven't been greedy, grumpy, nasty, selfish, or indignant. I'm very thankful for that. But in a few minutes, God, I'm going to get out of bed. And from then on in, I'm going to need your help. Amen. Thanks, guys. We'll talk about eight.